Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to The Hobcast, episode number
94.
It is. As we rush towards 100, we've got big plans for the 100th episode.
We do, but we're not going to tell you what it is yet.
No, we're going to keep that secret. Watch this space, as they say. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hoback Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Suspense.
Thrillers.
Mystery.
And crime. We've messed the order up this week.
Oh, I do it differently every week.
Okay. Our big guest this week is Greg Moss, who is a novelist. His first novel coming out, well, actually, about a week's time or so as we put this out. Two weeks' time. Yeah, it's pretty soon.
And it's coming here.
It is, yeah. We've ordered a copy. Couldn't wait to get our hands on that. He's been a director, a playwright, and, in his own words, an encourager of writers, particularly for theatre, but also set up a course with Sussex University.
He's a proper Renaissance man, isn't he? Because he's also been a teacher.
He's done all sorts, but he's incredibly wise and clear-sighted on what makes good storytelling and great writing. So we really took great pleasure in meeting him at Fatal Shore in Shoreham, part of Shoreham Wordfest, when we were there last week. And we couldn't wait to get him on the programme. And it just so happens he's the husband of Kate Moss.
Not the model.
The one with the E on the end. And she, of course, you won't need to be told, is one of the best-selling authors in the UK. And she may be joining us on the podcast
soon. She may, yes.
So that's Greg Moss to come. Can't wait to speak to him. Let's get into some news. And we had, there's a lot going on in the publishing industry.
There always is at this time of year.
Well, it's Frankfurt. And Frankfurt is the big international rights festival, which is being held in person for the first time in umpteen years, thanks to the pandemic. The bookseller reporting that everyone's delighted to be back.
And oh, it's so lovely, isn't it?
All of that stuff. Well, all very nice, I'm sure.
Our friend the Pineapple Man is there.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, I can't remember his name now, but we met him at London Book Fair. But the report is that Frankfurt is a lot smaller. Fewer people have been sent, and that's kind of a reflection of the wider industry at the moment and economic issues. But those that are there are reporting there's interest in rights sales and all sorts of things, and they're just happy to be back together.
Yeah.
I can understand that, but I don't think it masks the general trend, which is things are a little bit of a battle. And on that theme, we'll move on to a story from the bookseller about the mixed reaction to publishing's very own Super Thursday, which was not last Thursday,
the one before.
Which is when you release the big names for Christmas.
If you have a big name for Christmas.
Well, indeed, yeah. So A Heart Full of Headstones by Ian Rankin came out, the latest Rebus novel. It's currently number four in the charts. Number one was David Walliams with his latest book for Christmas. Number two, won't surprise you to know, it's Richard Osman.
Who's that then?
Quite. Do you know, actually, I'm just going to break away from this reflection on Super Thursday, because I was in Waterstones in Sheffield yesterday. I was accompanying my son on a...
You went... Oh, yeah, you did. You went to a bookshop.
I bought you a book. So I went into Waterstones. It's quite a big branch. Not a mega one, but quite a big one. And then there was you look at the tables, and there were Richard Osman in paperback, and then the Twyford Code by...
Janice Hallett.
Cover almost a complete carbon copy, and then another author with another carbon copy cream thing with black border, picture of an animal on the front, kind of thing. I mean, honestly,
it's a trend at the moment.
It is. I mean, since Richard Osman's books took off, everyone's doing it, and it just makes me sort of, I don't know, part of me scratches my head and thinks, can't we do something original? But it works, clearly.
It does work. I mean, I must admit, so Janice Hallett, I think you bought Janice Hallett's first book.
The Appeal.
Because the cover was intriguing. But at that point, it was only Richard Osman who had a similar cover.
Yeah.
And it just looked like sort of a modern, it was twisty, cosy.
Well, it was a kind of woodcut of feel to it. And actually, it wasn't as close to the Richard Osman as you might think. But the new one is. It's much, much closer.
Yeah, I've seen that one, yeah.
So, I can't remember who the other person was. Quite a famous author as well has gone down that route, or rather their publisher have. So, interesting. And I observed, one of the things I observed was, I mean, Waterstones were just awash with new product, which was great because I was watching the staff telling each other where to put stuff because they were kind of fighting. They were putting books down below on the tables. They have a little shelf on the bottom of the tables, stacking them up. And that's fine. That's fine. It just goes to show, I think, that Waterstones have cleared up their backlog system and things are starting to flow. Anyway, I go into the subject of Super Thursday. So lots and lots of big books came out. And normally, Super Thursday is a big day for the retailers as well because there's a pent-up demand for said big books. People rush out to get the copies first day.
When people start doing their Christmas shopping. I mean, not people like me or people like you, but there are people who will start in mid-October thinking about Christmas presents, and it kind of, that's how Super Thursday first came about. It was, you know, the rush to get the books that they knew were going to sell for Christmas published.
Yeah. Well, let's just work through some of these reflections on it. So there actually were more books in hardback published this Super Thursday than the previous year by quite a margin, actually. 340 published this year, 292 came out in 2021. This year, as we mentioned, Ian Rankin was amongst them, and Alice Oseman and Julia Donaldson, you know, who's, you know, frankly, the biggest name in young fiction in the world, probably, right now. The Edinburgh Bookshop said that Super Thursday, this is Marie Moser, had remained very strong, but they did especially well with two new picture books, Maggie O'Farrell's The Boy Who Lost His Spark and Chloe Savage's The Search for the Giant Arctic Jellyfish. catchy name. And with Halloween around the corner, Nick Sharratt's What's in the Witch's Kitchen flew out, while other adult titles, including Richard Osman's The Bullet That Missed and Lucy by the Sea by Elizabeth Strout.
She's I've read some of her books. They're right. Brilliant.
Were strong sellers.
Mm.
For the Main Street Trading Company in the Scottish Borders, the day evolved around an author event and sales were boosted by families coming into the shop during half term. Half term then, it's half term now.
Yeah.
So that's apparently Richard E. Grant's A Pocket Full of Happiness was popular in non-fiction. But, and I say but, there are some other bookshops, independent bookshops, which reflect difficult trade. For instance, the Blue Bear in Farnham. The shop's been struggling all year. This is according to co-owner Sylvia Schuller. In numbers, the 13th of October 2021, so last year, was £558 through the till. Mm. And yesterday it was £337, she said, of Super Thursday. And footfall has dropped by roughly 50%. And we're barely managing on a month-to-month basis. We sold 6 books on Super Thursday.
Mm.
And one of them was a leather-bound book for £30 of Chinese myths and folk tales. The rest of the money was made up by cafe items.
Oh, dear. That is sad. That's worrying.
And she says, if not for the dual aspect of our business, which is a tiny cafe, we would have had to close our doors already. I've not been able to draw a salary since February, and now with the high costs of electricity bills and goods and services, we're truly struggling. We were hoping for a good Christmas. However, with the daily news of retail not picking up, we truly do not know what will happen in the weeks to come. And also, despite the deluge of new titles, booksellers at Warwick Books also didn't see a particular spike on Super Thursday. And although sales picked up on the Saturday, trading was slow. In general, it's been a flat year, says co-owner Mog Harris. We're working really hard to just keep going. Publishers have brought out big titles, but with the big price increases across the board and tightening of people's budgets, I wonder if there's been a shift again to online purchasing or choosing places that offer big discounts.
Or just people aren't buying so many books. It could be as simple as that.
Well, I think that it's inevitable. It's inevitable with the state of things at the moment across the world that people just don't have the disposable income to spend on books.
I'll tell you what it could be. So in my case, I have quite a big pile of books I haven't read yet.
Yep, and you're working through it now.
I do go into Waterstones and I think, you know what, I'd love to buy a book, but I shouldn't because I've still got a few to read. And I know there are a lot of people who do have that issue. You know, they have the book. So that guilt of, I haven't got the money to spend on a new book, but I've got loads to read at home.
Well, I'm going to redouble my, because I was in Waterstones, I bought two books, one for you and one for myself as research for a project I'm working on. So it's one of those things where I just think we've got to go out and support the independent bookshops. In fact, we've got to support independent retail, really.
Well, I do it. I always buy, if I can, not in Stafford, because we haven't got any independent bookshops.
No, we haven't.
But when we go somewhere.
We haven't got any for miles around.
No.
We really haven't. In where we are, but that's not true of everywhere. But we really need to support, you know, whatever we can. But it's difficult. I mean, you know, I don't want to get drawn into the politics because by the time you might listen to this podcast, we'll have a new prime minister potentially. But goodness knows who it's going to be. But we'll leave all that nonsense that's been going on last week and drew my eye far too much at, like, you know, rubbernecking a car crash. Watching events in Westminster last week was just extraordinary. But on another subject, and I suppose it's a related subject, is that, you know, clearly publishers in this sort of environment are looking for surefire winners.
Oh, well, they are. They're a business at the end of the day. And what are you going to do? You think of an idea that's going to sell you more product with a lower budget, you're going to go for it.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, look, there's been a trend. I mean, we've talked about this on the podcast a number of times, and Richard Osman is a good example. It basically, you know, if you can get a celebrity to put their name on a book, whether they've written it or not, it's going to have a much, much stronger chance of selling. And this has been particularly true in children's fiction in recent years. David Walliams obviously is the flagship bearer for that particular phenomenon.
Quite a few of them have done it, though, haven't
but,
they?
But anybody who's been on the comedy circuit and has a reasonably well-known name within adult comedy circles has been writing kids' books.
Mm.
They have. And, you know, like Julian Clary and Joe Brand and people like that popping up everywhere. David Baddiel, you know. And I'm not saying they're bad books necessarily. They might be very good.
Dermot O'Leary wrote a children's book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, so let's add to that list with Jamie Oliver and Jerry Halliwell Horner. I.e. Ginger Spice. They've become the latest celebrities to announce new children's books, with experts saying there is no sign the celebrity-authored children's book trend will slow down.
Oh, it's speeding up.
Right. And Oliver's book, Jamie Oliver's book, is entitled Billy and the Giant Adventure, and it's based on a story he used to tell his children. Okay. It follows the title character and his friends who decide to explore the out-of-bounds Waterfall Woods. Billy and the Giant Adventure will be published in April by Penguin Random House UK, who will no doubt buy the number one spot for him, which also publishes Oliver's cookbooks with a sequel already scheduled for the spring of 2024.
I've just had a thought. I think the trendsetter of this sort of well-known people writing children's books was Prince Charles.
Do you think? What, the old man in Loch Nagar?
And then Madonna did one, didn't she?
Oh, yeah, she did, yeah.
But at that point, there weren't that many celebrities writing children's books.
No, that's true. That's true. You know, and it's probably a good thing because we'd have to sort of pulp a few of them. You know, imagine if, you know, your children's celebrity like Rolf Harris.
Oh, stop it.
Had written one. That might have been problematic.
Oh, but that does remind me. Do you know there is a book coming out, due to come out in 6 weeks' time, about Liz Truss's rise to power?
Yes. And, well, I thought, you know, I'll go back onto the politics thing. So Keir Starmer at opened Prime Minister's questions with, I gather there's a book about your, you know, rise to being Prime Minister, and it's out before Christmas. Is that the title of the book or statement of fact? And of course, she was gone the next day. So anyway,
out before Christmas, yeah.
Yeah, out before Christmas. And Jerry Halliwell Horner, who is married to Christine Horner, if you're wondering where the double
barrel. I don't
know
who that is.
He's the head of Red Bull Racing, the Formula One team. Anyway. Two book deal with Scholastic, and the first of those books is called Rosie Frost and the Falcon Queen, which is due in 2023, autumn of. So there'll be another
in time for Super Thursday.
Absolutely. It's described as an adventure story about an orphaned girl who is sent to a mysterious Bloodstone Island, home not only to a school for extraordinary teens. Here we go. Let's throw in a bit of Hogwarts in there, shall we? But also a sanctuary for endangered species. Oh, blimey, tick every box. The book follows the former pop star's previous children's book series. Oh, she had one before.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
About the adventures of 9-year-old Eugenia Lavender. Okay, so children's books now come out from... Here's a list of some of the celebrities in children's books.
Good,
okay?
Very convenient.
Okay, this is just a sample. David Walliams, mentioned already. Alicia Dixon.
Don't know who that is.
Former Strictly Judge, now judge on Britain's Got Talent.
Oh, right, okay.
And a former singer, or a singer. Lenny Henry.
Oh, yes, I knew about Lenny.
Tom Fletcher.
Don't know who that is.
He's in a boy band or something. Marcus Rashford.
Oh, Malcolm Rutherford.
Well,
excellent.
We knew that anyway. And Meghan, Duchess of Sussex.
Who's that? Oh, Harry and Meghan.
Yeah. Anyway. Right, well, you know, we've sort of, let's not dwell on this. anyway, that's obviously a trend that is continuing with Jamie Oliver entering the fray.
Well, here's a question for you then. Say somebody famous approached us with their crime novel and it was so-so, would we publish it?
Of course. I mean, how it depends on the level of celebrity-ness.
Oh, someone as famous as Jamie Oliver, say. I don't know. Heston.
Yeah, he would write a good one, though.
No, but this well, okay.
I think he would do... You see, if we were working with Heston Blumenthal, he'd be inventing new ways of killing people through cookery or something like that.
Oh, he could do a collaboration with Brian, couldn't he?
Yeah, he could. It'd be brilliant. Anyway, yeah, that's a possibility. Anyway, that is the news for this week. So let's get into we'll talk about our plans and our news, such as it is, a little later. But let's talk to Greg Moss, who, as we mentioned, has done many, many things. But I suppose number one thing is being an encourager of writers, which he goes on to explain how and why. But he really has made a big impact, particularly in getting people from unusual backgrounds into writing for theatre. And this is currently being run through the Criterion Theatre, which is in Piccadilly Circus, one of the great theatres. It's run by a charitable trust. And this has been going for 7 years. And it's, you know, for the writers involved, they don't pay a thing, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
So fundraising going in behind that. But what struck us when he was on a couple of panels was just how clear-sighted his thoughts were on what makes great writing. And so we didn't hesitate to get him onto the show. So let's speak to Greg Moss. One of the great pleasures, Rebecca, of going to a festival like Shoreham Wordfest and Fatal Shore is meeting new people, isn't it? I mean, that's why principally we go to these things.
Totally.
And we met Greg Moss at the back of the hall. And Greg, you made a massive impression on us on a number of fronts, not least on stage where you imparted some amazing advice, but also just... put us at ease, because we always go to these events slightly feeling that what's that sense of
imposter syndrome,
exactly what I was going to say, imposter syndrome sometimes when we go in, because we're quite new publishers, and although
we're actually both introverts as well,
that doesn't help either. So you put us at ease, and we thank you for that. Thank you.
It was a complete pleasure to meet you. And just on that thing about being introverted or imposter syndrome, I always think that we're all in that room together for the things that we know about. Me, hopefully, the book that I've written, the book that I'm about to write. You, about you, what you're looking for as publishers, both from the inspiration and the professionalism of the authors, but also the markets you're selling into. If anybody asks us any questions, those questions ought to be about things that we know the answer to.
Absolutely. That's so true. And I think that's partly why we go to these things, because there we are in amongst the people who we want to go and engage with our books and our authors and become part of their lives. And it's always very instructive. And actually, the more you go around the country, you see the themes emerge, but also the regional differences. But Greg, it was great to meet you, because you have such an amazing career story and a story to tell, really. But we're talking to you just ahead of the publication of your first novel, which is extremely exciting. And that, of course, is The Coming Darkness, which is coming out.
He's already ordered it.
Yeah, I have ordered it this morning. I can't wait
to read
it.
Happy days.
You got one guaranteed sale this morning.
Which is amazing. But, I mean, what I wanted to ask you first and foremost is that reading the blurb, it sounds like a really ambitious, big thriller. So what were the challenges
when you had, you know, you had your concept for your main character and the sort of ringer that you're going to put them through, to manage all of the scope of the book is quite something. So how did you go about that?
Well, I hope you still think that when you've read it, but I'm going to run with this idea and just say that my background as a theatre writer, and you can see me in my office with many of my theatre posters on the wall behind me, your play is made up of distinct scenes of drama. And surely your book should be the same. I don't want too much meandering internal reflection. I don't want too much description for the point of description. I want the dramas that my character's involved with to reveal the imaginary world of my novel a little bit at a time. One of the things that I said to, in answer to one of the questions from the hall, a very good question, which is similar to yours, how do you keep it all in your head? How do you manage? Well, my answer is you seldom need to be thinking about the novel as a whole. You should be involved in the specific scene of drama that you're writing. And each scene of drama should lead to a new narrative question. What happens next?
Yes.
Can I go just one step further as well? And I think this is a thing that perhaps is sometimes neglected in the teaching of writing. And the what happens next thing, if the reader reads on, well, they're going to find out the answer to that, aren't they? It's, I wouldn't say, it's not a superficial thing, but it is, just keep going, you will find out. On the other hand, the reader thinking about why is the character doing and saying these things is a much deeper form of suspense. So what next is simple, and you must have that to get your reader to turn the page. But to get them to really engage imaginatively, you want them thinking about why are they doing this? And of course, the promise is that that will be elucidated much later on.
Right. And that is such a difficult art. I think that, you know, I think that is the, in a nutshell, the difference between someone who can write a series of events that appear to be a plot and actually create an experience for the reader, take you deeper, involve them. Make them fill the gaps.
So I sometimes use this example of and I try and explain the difference between a story, which is just a bunch of things that happened, and a plot. And I'll tell people about how, oh, yes, well, I got up early and I was in a rush and I spilt the coffee and I went outside and got in the car and I got stuck in traffic and I shouted at all the other drivers. But eventually I got here and here I was talking to you. And it's just a sequence of events. But what if I got up early and I spilt the coffee and I kicked the dog and I got in the car and I got stuck in traffic. I shouted at all the other drivers. I parked badly. I ran in. I said hello and I had a heart attack. And it went somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And all of that stress and angst that if I told that story fully, it might take 1,500 words for the whole chapter. And it goes somewhere. And
yeah.
You don't know where it's going, but when it gets there, the reader should think, oh, yeah. But of course, they didn't see it coming.
Yeah, it made me sit up when you said that. And then I thought, what happened next?
Absolutely. One of the things that you describe yourself as is, what was the exact phrase? I'm not, you know, you enable an encourager of writers.
Encourager of writers, that's it.
And that I love, because there aren't enough of us around, in a way. I think there's an awful lot of people, there's a whole empire of people who think they know what good writing is and are quite happy to tell people that that's not good. But to encourage writers, and in particular your work currently with the Criterion Theatre in London, in terms of creating an environment where people without from all backgrounds, I mean all backgrounds, this is long before it became fashionable and every single publishing house had a prize to invite people who were from disadvantaged backgrounds and from alternate, you know, from diverse backgrounds to get into writing. You were doing it long before it became a thing that everyone had to be seen to be doing. So what's motivated that in you to go to that much trouble to find the funding to create that scheme?
So the answer is, loving theatre to start with and wanting to see more diverse voices represented, not just in the wonderful fringe theatres where I started my theatre career 40 years ago, but also on main stages. I was talking to a very close friend of ours who's now deceased, sadly, who this must have been 9 years ago. He was on the board at that time of the Criterion Theatre Trust. And you might not know, but many of London's theatres are actually run by charitable trusts and they have educational missions and other, and they fulfill them in different ways. And I went to see the managing director of the Criterion Theatre Trust, Fiona Callahan, and I said, if we run, at this time, I already had a lot of workshops behind me. I was, you know, a well-qualified encourager of writers. So I had a certain bona fides myself, so I could say to Fiona Callahan, if we bring together groups of playwrights on stage at the Criterion and give them the experience of devising their new work in that environment, they're far more likely to write something that fits that bigger space, that can cope with having 400, 700, 900 people paying attention to it. I think if writers don't feel welcomed in those spaces as creatives, not just as audience members, but as creatives, that's unlikely to happen. Where this led was a first set of six writers, and it went very well. That led to another set of six writers because we proved ourselves. That led to us putting on showcases in the autumn of each year, only interrupted by coronavirus, to free showcases. No money changes hands. This is it's a charitable enterprise fulfilling the mission of the Criterion Theatre Trust. And we've got to the point now where I've had at least 120 writers through the Criterion New Writing Programme. I'm currently recruiting writers for 2023. We've employed 50 or 60 actors who we feel we give a training in story development and editorial comment to as well. And of course, from all of those showcases, lots of directors have had the opportunity to put on extracts in that wonderful West End theatre.
Amazing. Amazing. And what have you gained from your own art, from working with these new voices? What has it given you in terms of the way that you approach your work?
I think being able to be an encourager of writers is a knack. And the knack that you need to develop is the knack of invention. Whatever the writer comes up with, I can say, oh, well, this could have happened earlier. This could happen later. I'll come on to how it's benefited me in just a moment. But just to say, and again, this is something I think we all know, but we don't always articulate, which is, the reader's engagement in our novels is principally with, well, obviously it's with the words on the page, but in addition to that, it's the gaps between the things that we express on the page. That's where the reader engages, wonders why, as I was talking about earlier, but also looks for narrative connections that haven't yet become apparent.
Yes.
It's in the counterpoint of sequence of events. I sometimes use a wonderful example from Hamlet, where the audience knows that Claudius, who murdered Hamlet's father, is going to pray, but the audience has been told that it's not going to work. He's tried before, and he just can't communicate. He's lost faith because of this terrible crime he's done. And then while he's praying, Hamlet comes in, and he says, now I could kill him. But if I did, he'd go straight to heaven.
Yes.
But Hamlet decides not to kill him after all, and off he goes. And then Claudius stands up and he says, my words fly up, my thoughts remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go. And so nobody says out loud, nobody explains what that means out loud. It's just the sequence of events. And what's meaningful in it is that Hamlet could have killed him and that would have been the end of the play, but he didn't.
Mm.
because of that mistake that he made, because he only had partial information. So that's where I was going with this, Adrian. There's these two things. The information we give the reader is always partial because it's just that moment in time, that point of view that we're writing. And we make a promise to our readers that later scenes will give you additional information that will help you to understand what you didn't understand at the time.
Yes.
And that keeps them engaged. Put that only really works if you have a fertile imagination, if you have the knack of invention, and that for any particular scene, perhaps an actor on stage at the Criterion has said, I'm not sure about my role in this scene. I felt like a spare part. And I need to come up with not one, not two, but three different ways of responding to that. And the reason that I have to come up with at least three different ways of responding to that perceived issue is because I mustn't come up with one and cling to it as the drowning man clings to his lifeboat. I must come up with several and then say to the writer, or another better idea that you can think of.
Mm. Yes. Mm. Yeah. So he's got the flexibility. He's got to have the flexibility of going in a direction.
Yes. And coming up with multiple ideas makes all the ideas less valuable, but the process of finding them easier.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Understood. I mean, it's very similar. When I'm going to cast back to my career in journalism at the BBC. And so one of the most enabling things that I ever went on, you get sent on courses the whole time. And most of the time now, I'm told it's to, you know, work as a journalist that's going to influence and protect the environment, or for instance, you know, all the sort of zeitgeist things that we're supposed to be worried about. But when they actually were doing training in terms of being a creative leader, which I went on, this is about 15 years ago, the principle of yes and in a meeting was passed on. Now, I'm sure this is really the foundation of a lot of good collaborative creative work in the theatre and in film.
We're in many creative.
Exactly. But in the BBC, when I joined, it was all about knocking each other down. You'd have your morning meeting and everyone would just tear into each other and say, well, that's a stupid idea. That was in The Guardian yesterday. We can't do that angle. You know, it was never yes and. But once I started employing this as a regular thing and changed the culture, it doesn't half improve the creativity that everyone is saying. They're not allowed to say no, but they're always to say yes and then we could do this. And at some point, out of all the ideas that come out of that positive environment, the right one comes forward, the most impactful and creative way forward.
Agreed.
Because you're not blocking their ideas, are you? You're allowing them.
I think it's creating that environment where, because I think the theatre has a lot to teach life, really, in the sense that I used to watch the theatre study students when I was at sixth form college doing their warm-ups and just laugh, frankly. I did a little bit of Amdram, but, you know, at school, but I didn't understand what they were trying to achieve. And I could see them doing all their trills and their, you know, flopping up and down and all that stuff and stretching and not realise what they were trying to achieve. I just thought it looked a bit, if I don't mind, I mean, I think we can get away with this in podcast. I thought it was wanky.
I wonder what you were going to say then.
But that's that was the cynicism of the 18-year-old me. Now I understand the importance of all of these things, of creating an environment. I think we're trying to do that with our company. But in your field, when you're working with new authors, it must be, you know, to create that environment when you get your new intake for 2023, when you're you know, you get them sat down and they're in the Criterion and workshopping. There'll be some there, I imagine. I'm rambling a bit here, but there'll be some, I imagine, who don't have the confidence to come forth immediately. And so your job is to create that environment where they can and their voice is valued. And that's not easy, is it?
I think two things. Three things. First one, you're describing the theatre studies students trying to find a state of mental and physical preparedness where they will have what we call flow, right?
Yeah.
That's what they're looking for.
Absolutely.
In my room at the on stage at the Criterion, I want the same. That means I need to provide enough stimulus that the writers are reassured about what they're trying to, what I'm asking them to do, and that it's within their reach. And then we will build on it. Do you remember when we were in the hall at Fatal Shore in Shoreham?
Yeah.
We had a, there was a moment when somebody asked a question about that thing you mentioned earlier on about like looking at your novel as a whole. And it was part of the answer I gave was what I said before, that you really are focusing on individual dramas and then you add them all together and that makes a novel. So, and we went on, somebody else took that question on and they said that the thing that sometimes upsets our process is that we start thinking like architectural critics about our own novels, as if it's something that's already been published and we're writing in the Times Literary Supplement a considered appreciation of all the clever things that we did in our writerly skillful way. Whereas when we're writing a novel, we have to behave as builders and we have to build it from the foundations up one brick at a time until finally we've got a house. And that also means that you have to be inside it, doesn't it? You have to be inside the novel and you must resist the temptation to be often standing outside looking at it from a distance.
Yeah.
So.
I think, well, it's very easy. I'm taking that analogy. It's very easy to give an idea for a novel curb appeal. But what you're, I mean, because we get propositions and, you know, we get submissions, even though we're closed at the moment, we still get them, where someone's come up with, it's a good angle. You think, right, okay, I can see that. I can see that, you know, as a one-line tag on the front of a novel. I can see the cover. I can see the principle that you're trying to illustrate. But what they haven't done quite often is all the foundations, the plumbing, the electrics, let alone putting in any soft furnishings.
Basically a new build.
No, what it is a cardboard cutout.
Yeah, a new build.
Yeah. So do you remember the Superman movie where Lex Luthor bought up lots of desert land in California?
Yeah.
So that he could put a nuclear bomb in the San Andreas Fault.
Yes.
And all the coastline would fall into the Pacific and he would have all the shorefront.
Yes.
So that works, doesn't it? Because it's basically, it's live action movie, but it's actually a cartoon story. We don't have to contemplate the fact that it would be a nuclear wasteland and all the people would get leukemia and, you know, so on. Because it, and also it's got, standing behind it, it's got these accepted characters. There's Lois Lane, there's Superman, there's Lex Luthor, there's the other people from the canon. But of course, the difficult thing that somebody who was writing a contemporary thriller with that idea in it would also have to sell you all of these unique and original characters that high concept novel was built with. Because that's what we're talking about, isn't it? The plumbing and the stairs, they're actually the characters in the novel with their competing objectives and wants and desires. Yes. It's what I'm saying is, even if you've got that really cool idea, that high concept idea, Jack Jordan spoke very well about the high concept idea on Saturday. And he obviously is a novelist who was self-published and then moved into mainstream publishing later on. He talked about the fact that the high concept can get somebody's attention, but then it has to be grounded in relatable human experience. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's right. I think that, I mean, your emphasis on character is so important here, because this is where a lot of things fall down. And I have to say that I had a little dip into your book, which you wrote in was published in 2014, Crafting Your Plot, a 60-minute masterclass. And it is.
Wow, that's
I managed 15 minutes. I did 15 minutes of it. And I came rushing into Rebecca about six times in those 15 minutes ago.
He did.
Here's another one. Here's another zinger. Here's another thing that, you know, you've articulated all the things that concern us when we see a manuscript. Now, we're great believers that if you get the characters right, if you bring them to life, you make them relatable, you give them that motivation, they've got to be
The emotion. Yeah.
Well, not so much the emotion as much as they need to be after something. They need to be competing against each other. They need to be interacting with each other. This is the key to any good fiction. The other things, you know, a cracking headline idea, great set pieces, all the stuff that, you know, those are important. But if you don't get the characters there, if they're just flat and wooden and unbelievable, you're dead. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, you have to have deep sympathy for them, don't you?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. You have to put yourself in their position, and you are constantly thinking, well, what would I be doing if I was in that?
Of course, in The Coming Darkness, because I'm set a little bit in the future and in this rarefied atmosphere of the French security services, I've got to tune into a particular way of thinking that infects those sorts of institutions. And so I'm very fortunate that in a previous life, I was an interpreter and I worked in Paris in some of these international organizations. And that gave me, it meant that as I was writing, you know, boardroom scenes and conference room scenes and so on, which makes it sound really boring, doesn't it? But as I was writing those scenes, it felt natural to me. And I think there's the way in which people in those organizations speak almost always guardedly, even if they've got nothing to hide. They tend to be quite non-committal. In fact, just as a small digression, again, in a previous life, when our children were small, I trained to be a secondary school teacher, so to sort of tie up all the loose ends of family life. And I was in my training, I was in a Roman Catholic comprehensive school in Hackney. And at the end of the teaching practice, I said to one of the nuns who taught there, "Do you have any advice for me, you know, going forward that I could take away?" And she looked at me and she said, "Never say yes in a corridor." Isn't that great? And I think that's how spies think. Never say yes in a court. Never say yes ever. Say, "That's interesting. We'll revisit that."
Or, yes. You
know, and so on. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Feeling at home in the world of your novel. Yeah, feeling at home in the world of your novel is really important. And that's like a step. So there's the empathy with the characters, but there's also feeling at home in the situations that you're trying to depict.
Yes. Yeah, that's very true. And you've sent another echo off in my mind, which was a boss of mine when I became a manager said, "Look, there's a simple way to manage in the BBC, and that is to simply say no." No matter what the request is, just say no. Well, and then you can correct yourself later, but never say yes, because someone will stop you from doing. You may say yes to someone, puts a proposal in front of you to go to, I don't know, travels to America to do a story, which was what we did a lot of because I was in the World Service, and I was encouraged to say no because there was always a financial justification for saying we can't afford to do that, and I refused to take that approach. I hated it.
Well, you should have used the Japanese phrase that they use, and it translates literally as "that might be a little bit impossible." Because I don't actually know.
Go on, say it in Japanese.
You always say, crikey, if I can remember, "tabun choto skoshi mori do moimasu." I think it might be a little bit impossible.
Very good, very good.
Very good.
Is Japanese one of your areas of interpretation?
No, it's not. No, I worked, I was what was called in French, biactif. And what that means is that you interpret from French to English and from English to French, that sort of both directions. And I also learned Spanish, and I eventually worked a little bit in Spanish, never very effectively, I don't think. It's a pathway to other cultures, isn't it? Language learning.
Totally.
It's again a story of empathy and understanding of others.
Yeah.
I mean, so I lived in Japan for 2 years, and you know, culture that you might think is very different from the British culture. There are lots of similarities. The way that they like I say, they won't give a direct answer because they don't want to embarrass you by saying no or commit themselves by saying yes. So everything is a sort of a level of, you know what they're saying, but they won't say what it actually means.
But can, like, I,
we do.
Can I try and bring all of this back into the writer confronted by empty screen question as well? Because
I
as it happens, I write each day from 6:30 to about 9:30, maybe 10 o'clock. And that's it for my creative writing day. And the rest of the day will be business and family life and everything else. So I bring that same attitude that all three of us are discussing. I try and bring that to my own personal party where I am alone with my characters and my screen and my keyboard. That, yes, and also, if he knows this now, is there a scene I should write earlier for my hero where he didn't know it? See, that's really fulfilling, isn't it? Because
yes.
And that's the way in which I think you can build a novel which is rewarding and complex, but still only be thinking about one thing at a time. An example of that might be, I'm working on the follow-up to The Coming Darkness, which is called The Coming Flood. You won't be surprised to hear. In The Coming Flood, there's a point at which Alex, my hero, Alexandre Lamarck, he discovers, he tries to get a rental car, and they're all bricked. In other words, they're all undergoing a software update all at once. And because this is 2037, there's no manual way of stopping that and making them all drive. And he says, but isn't that stupid that they should all do the software update simultaneously? And that, of course, makes him think about the thing that happened 2 weeks before when one of his colleagues said the same thing about he was in another country doing another desperately exciting and dramatic spy type thing. Mm-hmm. And he connects the two things and he thinks, well, this is meant. This is not a random event.
Mm.
And of course,
that happened in real life, don't they?
but I wrote the earlier scene after the later scene.
Yeah.
I realized that I could seed that idea with what seemed like a neutral, random event in the story that becomes meaningful later.
Yes.
And that, of course, is because I didn't say to myself, Greg, this thing about the cars all being bricked is really boring. My editorial brain kicked in and said, how can we make the most out of this? How can we make this meaningful? And that was the answer.
Absolutely. I'm intrigued. It took until lockdown to get to the point where you could write your novels.
Yes.
Why was that? Was it because you were so involved in the theatre at the time and
that was all gone, yeah.
You know, was that the opportunity?
So first of all, it was family life, looking after Kate and I, my wife, Kate Moss, and I have looked after three parents in our home for more than 20 years now. Her parents have both died. My mum is still alive. Then, of course, two children to put through school and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. One of whom I home educated for 4 years.
Wow.
That's its own, you know. Then, of course, working alongside Kate and all of her activities, supporting her work with the Women's Prize for Fiction, and beginning to develop this freelance career in story development, which is what I call it, Adrian. I always call it story development because I'm not editing, am I? I'm making things up, which I hope make your idea bigger and better.
Yes.
And if you don't like it, fine. I've got another idea coming along behind. So then when our children left home, I had the opportunity to go back to my very first career, which was theatre. And I think I added them up the other day. I think I wrote and produced, or other people produced, 25 original scripts of mine, some of them written in collaboration, some with my composer partner, because I also write musicals and plays with songs. And then, as you were saying, Rebecca, it all suddenly became illegal to come together in a room and watch a play. See you later. And so I had to find a new direction because I couldn't sit at my computer each morning at 6:30 doing the crossword, could I? I had to find something else. and yeah. was in fact the writing of novels.
And all of the things that have led up to that, the different formats, you know, the writing plays and everything like that. And also, of course, sharing the journey that Kate has gone on, that's hugely successful journey. But it must, how did you get, I mean, because my feeling is, and I'm sitting here trying to sort of judge, if I was in that position, what would I be feeling? I think it would be quite overwhelming in the sense that, you know, you're married to one of the most successful novelists in the UK. That's quite a challenge then to go into that world as well, isn't it? Or did that not cross your mind?
But you know, when I write a play, it might not be as good as Hamlet, but it might still be worth something.
Yeah, no, so, I'm not saying it wouldn't be.
No, I've realised, you probably can't quite see, but there's a lovely poster on the wall for a show that was the first show that I put on out of lockdown, which was called The Unquiet Grave.
Yes.
And it's a one-act play based in a traditional Suffolk folk song, and it tells a story of family life, and in part through this sequence of songs, brilliantly performed by two actresses that I've worked with four or five times in, you know, professional shows. And the idea for it is not completely novel, and The Unquiet Grave is somebody else's traditional song, as were the other songs in the show. But the way in which I put them together is, for better or worse, a product of my individual unique sensibility and sense of dramatic structure. And the test is, isn't it, that when people come to see the show, whether they applaud or leave in droves, and happily they stayed and they applauded, so great. But that is what that is really, in the end, the only thing that we've got to sell, isn't it? Our own unique sensibility and our intuitive sensibility and our own objective sense of structure in storytelling. Those two things together.
Well, clearly this first novel is of an international thriller, and you know, it's I'm very excited because this is my world. I love this sort of thing, and I see a comparison in the previews to I Am Pilgrim, which it gives me very excited. You've got you've got the novel out and the one to follow. What else are you working on at the moment in terms of novels?
I have another novel sequence that I started before coronavirus. I don't know if you recall, back in, let me see, so February 2020, one of the very last international writing festivals to take place was the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature in Dubai, that Kate and I have attended many times. I think it's perhaps in its 15th year, something like that. At that festival, I did a couple of platforms with a close friend of ours, Luigi Bonomi, who is a wonderful agent, Luigi Bonomi Associates. And he and I said to one another, oh yes, that's a really good idea for a sequence of novels. So in my spare weekends, no, I mean, what it was in my enforced isolation and unemployment of lockdown, once I had completed that first draft of The Coming Darkness, and it had not yet been sold to a publisher, so I wasn't working through all of those other drafts, you know, the structural edit, the line edit, the copy edit. I began writing another sequence, and I shared, I think, 25,000 words with Luigi, and I said, is this what you meant? And he said, yeah, more or less, but don't do this and do that. And I said, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. So that, which has not yet been announced by our publisher, that will be the next project. And that's a separate series set at a different moment in time with a different hero.
Fantastic.
So do you think you're now hooked on novel writing?
Yes, it's immensely satisfying. And also, Rebecca, because my approach is focused on getting that complex mechanism of plot down and sorted. So I don't second guess myself in that first draft. Do you remember when we were talking about first draft for me, then second draft I'll show to Kate, my wife?
So
I don't second guess. I just need the whole story down. I'll tell you just a little story. A few years ago, I was working with a writer writing a wonderful book set in the Arab Spring, and she found it very hard work. And it took her years. And she said to me, she described one day, she said, it was like I had to carve every word in stone. And then what happened, I said, because now you seem much more comfortable there. And she said, yes, well, the moment I wrote the end, it all became plastic and malleable and I could do what I wanted with it. And that was a big moment. Adrian, earlier you asked me what I learned a lot from all the interactions with all the writers I support. But that was a really big one. Get to the damn end of that first draft, for better or worse.
Yes.
And it will become something that you can shape and improve.
Mm. Yeah, I would subscribe to that, because I've struggled to get to the end of the projects I'm working on. But I know what the end, you know, I have a sort of in my head, I know how those things end. And actually, I think I might just get them down so that I know where I'm aiming. And I think what you describe in as I say, the book that I was looking at earlier, from 2014, you talk about a river. Life is a river, which sort of gets wider and wider and then goes into the void. But actually a book, if you're reflecting life, you actually have to reverse it so that the shallow waters at the start are quite wide and then it gets narrower and deeper and faster as you accelerate towards the end. And I think that's a really useful mental image that has helped me think, right, I now know where I'm going with, you know, and I've been sitting and looking at my work in progress for months.
Years. For no, years.
Years. Years. Not really.
Not months.
I get into the flow state you talk about, and it's wonderful. But actually, it's not finishing it. I'm just adding
You've
more
got sections.
And more.
It's like a jigsaw piece with lots of the pieces missing, you're writing.
Yeah, and just reading that this morning took me back to my protagonist and what I needed to do to set her up properly, that I'd rushed her into the rapids far too quickly. I hadn't set up her background life, the thing that she's going to have to always regret leaving. Oh dear, battery's running low. We might have to do something about that in a second. But that crystallized for me in how you described it.
So it's interesting, isn't it, how different ways of speaking respond, work differently for different people. So that image, which I like very much, of the river Thames, for example, opening out into its estuary and dispersing itself into the North Sea, and you don't really know where the river ends and where the sea begins.
Yes.
But of course, in your novel, it can't be like that. It must narrow to a unifying climax.
Yes.
This again, Fatal Shore was a lovely event. We, all of us who are publishing professionals, whether that's authors or publishers or bloggers, everybody, I think, very generously moved around the room and spoke individually to participants at the festival. And one of the participants that I was talking to was asking this very same question about how you get to that unifying climax at the end of the novel. And the way I tried to describe it was that if Rebecca gets what she wants, well, Adrian can't have what he wants and Greg can't have what he wants. But if Greg gets what he wants, then it's Rebecca who loses. And it's
exactly.
All the characters are... they all have skin in the game, and in those last pages, it's resolved who is successful, who is partially successful, and who loses.
Yes.
But all in the same narrative sequence, all in the same drama. Those are the best novels, and I think also the best plays. I sometimes say to playwrights that at the end of the play, all the characters should be on, as in on stage.
Yes.
And the reason for that is because they should all still have skin in the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
If not, right. do they really have a home in this play? If they're not still involved in that last scene, what have they been doing?
Quite. Yeah. That's very well put.
Yeah.
Well, Adrian, they're bystanders, aren't they?
Exactly. Well, I was absolutely. Thinking that they're bystanders.
And,
yeah.
this is something that I think we've imparted to some of our authors, you know, when we've received certain, you know, might be the whatever month draft finally comes to the publisher and we say, well, you know, they're not doing anything. So why are they there? They're not adding to this and they're not invested.
Here's another one, which I think is really useful. I don't think it was in that little book that I wrote for The Guardian. If you can put your book aside for a couple of weeks, I don't mean yours, one puts one book aside. You pick it up again. And as you're reading it, you must think to yourself, is this sequence that I'm reading, is it descriptive or dramatic? And if it's descriptive, well, then you should probably fix that.
Mm.
Because the world of the book should be revealed by the dramas of the plot. It shouldn't be a descriptive book which sets up dramas. Another way of thinking about this is I often get asked about how do you reveal the locations in the novel? Well, you reveal the locations by the characters exploring them.
It's through their eyes.
That's right. It's through their eyes. And yes. one way of imagining it is is that they bring light to the landscape and illuminate it for the reader by their presence.
Mm.
And
I like that.
So if you keeping either one or the other of those two things in mind, I think is quite helpful. Is this descriptive or is it being revealed? What I want revealed, is it being revealed through drama? And it being revealed through drama, even modest, low-key drama, is better than none.
Totally. Totally. This was an interesting thing that you wrote early in that book. And you basically said, look, these are the foundation blocks, the sort of four bits that of DNA that make up a novel. They are actions, emotions, dialogue, and description. And I suppose that depending on what type of book you're writing, actions and dialogue will be perhaps stronger in a thriller than the emotions, though those are important. And certainly the description will be less important than, or at least less prominent. I shouldn't say important. That's still important, but you have to still impart some of the world. But as you say, you're seeing it through drama and you're seeing it through characters, which is very different from perhaps literary works, which will disappear off into a world of beautiful language and description.
There is that, but we don't underestimate beautiful language, do we?
No, not at all.
I love beautiful language.
So a sort of a 19th century example might be the beginning of Bleak House with the magnificent description of the fog in London, which is a kind of wide shot. And then, and then it comes into a mid shot, and then finally it's a close up, and then there we are in the Jarndyce versus Jarndyce trial that will never end and has blighted the family for several generations, and so on. And you could imagine a similar sequence in a thriller where, let's say, that there's the vast landscape of the South Pacific. And then the island in the distance. And then you're realizing, oh, we're flying, right? And as we come in, we can see the airport and the helicopter lands. And we get out and we run and there's a sound of gunfire. You're doing the same thing that Dickens did, but you're doing it with an action sequence which incorporates description. Whereas Dickens has stepped back into the author voice and provided you with this neutral author summary of what it looks like, only eventually arriving at the action. And I think that's a common distinction that we can see between literary fiction and commercial fiction. Commercial fiction is unlikely to do the former.
Mm.
Literary fiction is likely to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, we ought to draw this interview to a close soon because we're conscious of time, and we're so grateful to you for spending some time with us. And obviously we're hoping to speak to Kate next week, which will be amazing. So we'll draw some of these perspectives. I wanted to ask you one question because of my personal connection with the place. You're in Chichester.
Yes.
And a lot of your productions I see, you know, I went through your website and see that a lot of them are developed and performed as part of the Chichester Festival, which is a fabulous thing. And what a wonderful city it is because of the theatre there and the connection with Sir Laurence Olivier, who set it all up, you know, who helped get the money in for the brilliant building that it is. All of those things. How much does Chichester feed back into your work, do you think?
Well, wherever you are, there are opportunities, aren't there? So, and when I started writing plays, I, not my first career when I was in my 20s, but this latter career, which I thought would be my last, you know, the novels interrupted what I thought would be my last career of theatre. The first few performances of original work that I'd created had 30 or 40 people in a village hall. By the time theatre was shut down by coronavirus, I had sell-out performances of 300. And we with my collaborators, we'd taken our shows to other cities, to London, to Manchester, and so on. But you've got to start where you are. And you've got to take advantage of the opportunities that, as they present themselves. Do you remember when one of the very first questions on one of the panels was about gatekeepers?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the agents. Joe Furness started by saying, well, should we really talk about it as gatekeepers? And I said, well, if it's not gatekeepers, it is bottlenecks. These are obstructions for what you want to do. And if you're not finding it easy to get an agent, to get publishers to read your work, if you can't afford to go to the literary consultancy and spend perhaps several hundred pounds on an editorial review, well, what can you do? Well, you can go and read an extract of your work at a scratch night. You join a writer's group. You can publish chapters online. You can go to Ko-fi and you can say, you can read this for free, but if you like it, will you give me £2.50 to buy me a cup of coffee? You know, that lovely idea of...
Yeah.
The one thing you don't want to do is to write and then keep it to yourself. You must find, and that was what I did in theatre, Adrian. I found a way to take the first small steps, and that led to other steps. And through all of the shows that you see behind me, all the writers, all the actors and performers, yeah. the musicians, where that was, they were all paid for their work. And they were all paid from ticket sales. And so that's important too, that there is, there's what the Arts Council would call, there's a self-supporting future, you know, even if it's not right now, in the future, this can support itself. And that's what we want, isn't it?
Yes.
Even if we're self-publishing, we want to professionalize our process of creating really well-written and well-produced books. And we want that to have an entrepreneurial return. And that, I think, helps with our focus too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, it's your goal, doesn't it?
It's vital. I mean, you know, you can't do everything for free all life. I mean, it's just not.
But don't you think it's interesting, though, if you work in a creative field, whether it's art or theatre or writing or music, you feel almost embarrassed to ask for money for your work, that you should be doing it for love.
I think that's a cultural thing.
There's a perception of that, isn't
there? I think that's a very UK thing. I really do. I really do. I just don't think that other countries have got that hang up.
Well, I hope not. Kate and I recently went to a wonderful festival, North Cornwall Festival, it's not an enormous, it's not like a metropolitan area. It's a small rural community, and I would expect, so, you know, we asked for our expenses, but we didn't ask for money, you know. Because we want that North Cornwall Festival run by the wonderful Patrick Gale, to be back on its feet and successful for years to come.
Sure.
And times at the moment are very hard, aren't they?
Mm. Well, they are. They are. I keep looking at my phone to see whether Liz Truss has gone yet.
No, stop it.
In real time.
A real-time drama.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I ought to say my connection with Chichester. I was a reporter there for a year. I had an office in Sadler's Walk, the little shopping centre, and near the McDonald's. And I didn't realise my privilege at the time of where I was. I think when I left and I moved to Brighton to become the reporter there for the BBC, that was obvious. I mean, as someone described it, I think it was Joe actually saying, whoever came down from Salt Dean, it was always the Rotting Dean or whatever. It was like the Las Vegas of the South Coast, and it did feel that way. With Chichester, it's the well-heeled, God's waiting room. When I first went there, that's how I felt about it. But actually, it's a very vibrant place because it is, it's an astonishing area.
I've never been, so I don't know.
Chichester Harbour is just jaw-dropping. The beaches.
Yes, it's all very lovely. We are extremely fortunate.
And then you've got the fire, the creative fire of Lord March, or now the Duke of Richmond at Goodwood, who brought so much energy and money into the area and sort of panache, I think is the way I would describe
it. Isn't that perfume?
It is a perfume, yes. But he brought flair to the whole thing. I know he created a lot of enemies for bringing fast motor cars back to the circuit, but
the Festival of Speed and then the revival meeting where people dress up for the 50s or the 30s.
Yeah, it's amazing.
They are incredible achievements. And we, where we live, we can hear those events going on for the weekend. But it would be very curmudgeonly to say that this is a bad thing.
Mm.
It brings so much employment, enjoyment and excitement. It's wonderful. Yeah. And it's not every weekend, is it?
I used to cover those events, and I went to the very first revival meeting. My journalistic life was dominated by the story of would he be able to reopen the circuit, and talking both sides of the argument, the neighbors saying it shouldn't be allowed and all this sort of thing. We didn't move here because la la la, if we get this noise we'll have to move away and all that stuff. It was in the most amazing emotional occasion. And I'll just break in with an anecdote, but this is something I treasure, this memory. I was there for the revival meeting, and I was introduced to Sir Jackie Stewart and then Ken Tyrrell, who was the team owner that had been the team owner of Jackie Stewart's successful three championships and all that sort of thing. Then the really emotional kicker bit was the clerk of the course from that period, who had phoned Ken Tyrrell to say that he was seeing Jackie Stewart come down from Scotland and was driving around setting amazing lap times. No one had ever heard of this kid. He phoned up Ken Tyrrell and said, I found one for you.
Huh.
And that's how their relationship started. And they had seen each other for over 30 years. And there they were, all of them. And so Jackie Stewart's as hard as nails, even though he's lovely, they were all crying.
Aww.
And I had my microphone in the middle of this conversation. And I will never forget it.
Wonderful.
It was just amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. Just one of those things. And I'm just a kid from BBC Southern Counties Radio at the time.
With a big flop of ginger hair, probably.
With a big flop of ginger hair.
a
terrible Alan Partridge racing green blazer.
I need one of those.
I didn't have a blazer badge. But it was an amazing moment. And so Chichester spends, it's an important part of my life, albeit I had to live in Bognor Regis to work there. So that was the downside, but never mind. Right.
Paul Bognor.
let's get to the crux of this interview. I mean, Greg, you've shared so much wisdom and fabulous knowledge, and inspired many people listening to this. But now's the point they've really been waiting for, which is let me give the build up. Rebecca's random question.
If you could be reborn as a scientist, what branch of science would you specialize in and why?
Oh, it's really good. I wonder could I be permitted to be reborn into the future?
Yes, why not?
Because I think that the challenges that we're facing all of us, refugee populations, water shortages causing people to lose their homes, wildfires, desertification. These are all obviously linked to environmental degradation.
Yeah.
And I don't think that, I mean, I don't think there's anything more important that I could do than to find ways, whether that's geoengineering or alternative energy sources or hydrology, you know, water management. One of those fields has to be what you would want, where you could make the most significant achievements. And in part, of course, I say that because Kate and I have recently become grandparents. So we're now no longer thinking about our lives and our children's lives, 2050, 2070. We're now thinking about the year 2100 and what will the Earth look like then. So that's my answer to your excellent
That's a great
answer. It was a great question too.
For me, I want to be a behavioral neuroscience and understand people's brains.
Wow. Do it.
Okay.
There's still time.
I mean, look.
You got 3 degrees. I don't think I can go back.
And in my case, I would like to be in a position, because my father was a scientist. So I would love, and I was hopeless. I absolutely flunked all of the O-levels. In science, first time round, I was terrible. So I'd just love to be in a position where I understood enough science to be able to have a conversation as a peer.
With your dad?
With my dad on that. I mean, I can talk about all sorts of other subjects, especially history. We're on a level.
But your dad knows a lot about everything, though. His dad is a very, very intelligent person. And I sit there and I just go, oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. His brain is extraordinary. I've never been able to even remotely meet him a fraction of the way with what he was working on
with the science,
in Cambridge,
yeah.
With all these Nobel laureates around him. And that is a sadness to me that my brain doesn't understand and doesn't compute this stuff. And actually, it was an area of conflict in my youth because he could not understand how his son could not do the very basics of physics, chemistry, and biology. Yeah. And I couldn't. I just simply couldn't. I just don't have that brain.
No, you're a creative head.
Yeah.
Not
so
science.
That would be where I mean, I don't think it's necessarily going to help the world, but it would certainly help me feel a lot more comfortable with my life. So that's where I'm going.
On the side in your spare time.
Yeah, I'm sure I could. I'm sure I could. Greg, it's been an absolute pleasure. Really has. And we wish you every success.
Thank
with
you.
The novel, which comes out on November the 10th. And that is going to be fantastic.
And all the novels that you haven't come up with yet, they're in your head.
We really look forward to also speaking to Kate. We have made arrangements for next week, have we not?
Tentative, yes.
Tentative arrangements.
Good. It's been a complete pleasure. Lovely way to spend a lunchtime. And from my side, I think that over these last 20 years or so, there's been conglomeration in publishing, hasn't there?
Sure.
And publishing has become less nimble, less agile. And companies like Hoback put the agility back into publishing. And I think you're doing an incredibly valuable job.
Thank you. That's very sweet of you to say. Well, we hope so.
Can we record that and play it every day when we're feeling a bit down?
We will. Because the creative process is never straight. That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Greg. And as I say, The Coming Darkness is coming out very soon. And we can't wait to... when it flops on my doorstep, I'm really looking forward to that.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Lovely to speak to Greg Moss. And we can now exclusively reveal that we are speaking to his other half, Kate Moss.
For next week's show.
And she has a new book out, which is looking at I'm redacting it a little bit, but the sort of feminine icons of history.
Mm.
So it's a non-fiction book, but... she's touring the UK at the moment promoting the book, and she's coming to speak to us.
Yeah,
so,
in fact, she was touring last week.
She was. And we can't wait to speak to her. Again, you know, a powerhouse couple of British literary scene.
Just like us.
Well, and you know, let's not also forget, she's also the vice chair of the National Theatre, amongst other things. So, you know, she really knows her stuff, and it's a great honour to have her on the show. Which we can't wait. So that is Kate Moss. We've got some great shows coming up. We've been invited to take part in another event in the library, Halifax.
Oh, yes. So on the 10th of December, if you're in Halifax, well, you need to get a ticket. Tickets are free. So this is being organised by the lovely RC Brigstock.
Bridgestock.
I do apologise. The reason I stumble is because when I worked at OUP, I worked with an author who was a very large personality called Hugh Brigstock.
Yeah.
And he famously, when we sent him his cover design for his book, which was the Oxford History of Western Art, rang me up and he said, "Over my dead body, are you publishing my book with a naked body on the front?" Because it was about Western art, so there was a nude painting.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, that's scarred you for life, I bet. Over my dead body.
And he threatened to go to the top. And then so I went to the top to warn the top that the author was going to contact him. And the top said, "It's an art book. What does he expect?"
Smut. Filth in front of my cover. Oh, wonderful. Well, yes, Bob and Carol Bridgestock are organising this event. And we're delighted to be invited and taking part. So the 10th of December for tickets to Halifax Noir. What's it called? Noir, I can't remember.
Yeah, no, it's Halifax Noir, but it's taking place in the Peace Hall. The Peace Hall, so yeah, in the library next to the Peace Hall.
We had a fantastic visit there just after we went to Harrogate for Harrogate Noir. It was just brilliant. And you're going to have to stop me from buying more caricatures from the man who sells caricatures.
Yes, I am, aren't I?
Yeah, because it's just a brilliant shop. So I've got a lovely one of Clive James, which is looking across, and one of John Thor as Morse I picked up there. I just love them. So, yeah, brilliant. Can't wait for that. So in the week to come, well, next week.
We are publishing a book.
We are. We are. So we're going to be talking to at some point.
Well, he's already been on the podcast. This is Rob Gittins.
Okay.
The Devil Bridge Affair.
Well, he will appear on the show to talk about a little bit about what this latest book is. It's brilliant. Set in Wales.
Yes, the Devil's Bridge Affair. And timely for the spooky time of year, because it's the psychological thriller, but it's also sort of, it's got a level of mythology and folklore in it as well, and it's all about people and the effect the mythology has on the people. So
it's terrific. It's about those levels of consequences and legacy that he talked about when he spoke to us in his big interview when we released I'm Not There. Not so long ago. So The Devil's Bridge Affair coming out from Rob. And then we will be talking to Maureen Myant in the very near future, I imagine.
Yes, because her book is actually publishing 2 weeks after Rob. So
that's called The Confession. So that's one to look out for. Don't forget to check out all of our news and stuff on our social media channels, but also on our website, www.hobeck.net. In terms of this week, it's half term, so we have to sort of weave in various things you need to do with kids at half term, like buying new shoes or taking them to see elderly relatives or all those sort of things that are obligatory, and trying to make something of a week with iffy weather, which, you know, goodness knows what it's going to do this week. But yeah.
I mean, if you look at today, for example, it was absolutely pouring of rain when we woke up, but look at the skies now.
Well, the approach roads to our village were completely flooded. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I bought the 4x4, because just needed to be able to get in and out, which we couldn't do a couple of, you know, when we first moved here. It was really, really difficult at times, some of the floods. But it was, floods everywhere. It was quite spectacular. In fact, at one stage, I decided to be a real boy. And I was taking Toby to have his golf lesson. And when we got back, I said, right, we're going through this puddle, you know, and I put my foot down from a standing start, and just the wash over our car was huge, but it was fun.
I think we should also tell everybody that we've tried a new healthy diet this last week. So last Saturday, when we were in Brighton, we met up, I think we talked about this on the podcast, we met up with an old friend of yours from your school days.
Ant, yeah.
And so Ant was passionate about this diet that he'd adopted, him and his wife. And it was a
high-fat,
low-carb diet. So the keto thing that you see. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so we thought we'd try, at least to some degree, this diet, didn't we? And
well, I think it's all in, you have to be all in or not. But yes, we've adapted our diets.
Well, we cut down quite significantly on carbs.
Yeah, big
so,
time.
But
yeah.
I really enjoyed it. You know, it was great flavours and salads and the meat and eggs for breakfast. I loved it. That is until Friday.
Don't go any further.
So you talk about the blockages at Waterstones.
Right, okay.
I had the same problem.
I'm getting the picture.
What do you mean you're getting the picture? You were there.
I know. But I'm just trying to sort of protect the audience from that thought. I can't believe we're talking about bowels in this particular episode of the Hobcast.
So it's all sorted now, I'd like to say, but I had a difficult day on Friday and I was trying to work, but I just couldn't concentrate. It's really strange. No, I couldn't focus. Difficult.
No, absolutely. I think a lot of people were with you on that one. But let's not delve too deeply.
So next week we're going to balance it. We're going to eat healthily, but with a little bit more reality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, look, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast Book Show, wherever you get your podcasts from. We'd greatly appreciate that. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
And from the cat who didn't make an appearance this week.
No.
We'd like to thank you for joining us. And we wish you a wonderful and...
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hoback Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoback online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.